Welcome to Authorial Intentions, a series of conversations about recently published or forthcoming books by faculty in Vanderbilt University's Divinity School and Graduate Department of Religion. I'm Chris Benda, Theological Librarian at Vanderbilt University's Divinity Library, and today I'll be talking with Bruce Morrill, Edward A. Malloy Chair of Catholic Studies and Professor of Theological Studies, about his recent book, The Essential Writings of Bernard Cook, A Narrative Theology of Church, Sacrament, and Ministry. The book is made up of a selection of published and unpublished writings by Bernard Cook, whom we'll talk about in more detail very soon, and those writings are interlinked and commented upon by Bruce. Bruce, thanks for agreeing to this interview.
My pleasure.
So, to start off, who was Bernard Cook, and how did this project of producing a volume of selections from his writings come about?
Yes, Bernard Cook was an American Catholic theologian whose publications spanned from the late 1950s to the early 2000s. He's an important figure because of the role he had in setting up and leading originally American theological faculties in versus Roman Catholic theology being taught such that someone goes to Europe, men go to Europe, get educated in France, Germany, Rome, come back and dispense that. So he was a man who had been a Jesuit for many years of his adult life, and the Jesuits of the Missouri of the Midwest, where he was a member, recognized very early that he was a brilliant young man and a gifted for theology. And eventually, they had the vision that they wanted to found a program not of theology to train priests, not a seminary, but a graduate program for lay people, for men and women who were not ordained. And so he was sent, in fact, given his choice to where he wanted to study in Europe. He went over and did his doctorate. He ended up doing his doctorate at the Institut Catholique in Paris. Came back, and within a year of finishing his doctorate in his middle 30s, was founding the graduate program in theology at Marquette University. So that's Cook in terms of his impact institutionally in the United States. He was at Marquette for about 13 years, I think it was 13 years, till the late 1960s. In that time, they got both a master's and then a PhD program going at Marquette, which very quickly became quite notable. The Second Vatican Council was happening at the same time from 1962 to 65. He very humbly turned down an archbishop and two bishops' request to be there theologian at the council. It always blows me away when I think of that. But his answer was, I'm busy getting this program started. I can't go away in the falls. But for Archbishop Dearden of Detroit, he would meet with the archbishop during the summers because the sessions were only in the fall. And so there was some input. So Cook did that. But also, amidst all that busy teaching, administrating, all sorts of things, he began his publishing career. And over his career, published 24 books and monographs, and just scores and scores and scores, of course, of articles and book chapters and talks and all that kind of thing. Cook left the Jesuits in the late 1960s, and in doing that, also had to leave Marquette University. In that period, still, it would be seen as, I suppose, scandalous, or at least inconsistent, if a man left the priesthood, or in that case, the Jesuit priesthood at a Jesuit institution to continue there. And so he taught at several other institutions. So how did it end up that I have this project? For 10 years after Marquette, he taught at two different faculties in Canada, the University of Windsor in Ontario, where he was brought in with the hope that he would start a doctoral program, but the funding never materialized. It's a province, government-oriented university. The money didn't happen. And then in the second half of the 70s, he went out to be a founding member of a religious studies department at the University of Calgary. quite forward-thinking. Again, they hired a Jewish, a Muslim, and a Christian scholar. They were the three of them, and they taught intro courses, the three of them together, which is pretty cutting edge when you think of 1975.
Wow.
But in 1980, he accepted a full professorship at another Jesuit institution, Holy Cross, which is a liberal arts college in Massachusetts, and that's where I was an undergrad. So he came onto the faculty in my last year of college with quite a bit of fanfare. I mean, for that small liberal arts college, which doesn't run graduate programs, they were thrilled to have this guy. And I had him for courses, and then over the years kept in touch with him. He was quite a mentor to me. When he died on his 91st birthday in 2013, in May of 2013, I learned about 5 or 6 months later from his widow that they gave me his unpublished memoir and all of his papers and his library, and she said with the express hope that in some way I would get it out to publication, the memoir. And it became clear to me, it's quite compelling, actually. It's 44,000 words. It needed a lot of editing, especially as he was he was writing it really within the year of his death, and he was 91, and you know, just less strength. But so what I decided was, and I checked, and I was not surprised to learn from publishers that they were not interested in just simply flat out publishing his autobiography, as it were. And I wasn't sure that would be helpful either, quite frankly. What I wanted to do, since his theology methodologically was based on the idea that human experience is the fundamental locus of religious and divine experience, why not integrate selections from the memoir with selections from that voluminous publishing that he did. And he published across the range. He was best known as a sacramental theologian, but in fact he wrote a lot of fundamental theology. He published he published a Christology, he published a pneumatology. I mean, the guy in ecclesiology, his most famous book is Magnum Opus, 600 double column pages, single authored, is on ministry, history and theology of ministry. So I mean, the guy was just, you know, a full range theologian. So that's how I structured the book. We can talk about that later, but why I wove it together as I did. The feedback I got from the referees, Paulus Press sent the proposal out to referees. They certainly encouraged that my voice be strong in it as well, which I planned on. So as you mentioned, I write a lot in the way I relate all the material, and then connected, I think, to our current situation.
So, how did, you've indicated how large his memoirs were, and the volume as it's published obviously doesn't have huge amounts. I was wondering how you went about selecting. I mean, obviously, as I'll mention later, you have certain sort of categories. Did you have these categories in mind as you were looking at the text?
It was, really a process of simultaneity at the beginning. So I began in a summer, I had a full year's leave of absence, or what I would call a sabbatical, from Vanderbilt Divinity a couple years ago. I had a fellowship at the Catholic University of Leuven in Belgium in the fall, and then this visiting chair at Fordham University in the spring. So I knew I had that whole year ahead of me with my time was mine, blah, blah, blah. Man, I hit the ground running because I was so taken with the project. And by then, all the boxes of paper material had reached me. So what I did was, first of all, I read the memoir all the way through. And then I began working hard at editing it. Not that he was a very good writer, but it just, needed editing.
Everybody needs editing.
And so I worked on that, and especially also checking historical things and so forth to make sure that I understood. At the same time, I began revisiting all of his work and meeting a lot of his work that I'd never read, especially what was sent to me. These would have been off-prints of articles and book chapters and so forth, some of which I had read, but a lot of which I hadn't. having read the memoir through once, so the categories were generating, but also realizing that he was a theologian who covered the full range of topics or doctrines of Christian theology, the idea was, basically pretty quickly to create a book that would have major sections in which we covered how he saw faith and revelation, Christ, God, Spirit, sacraments, church, and ministry. And then to work with the memoir in ways that could present that material. But it was, as one might imagine, it was on the front end a good solid 6 to 8 months of working between all of that material to finalize the scheme finally. And then to work out the details, especially in selecting from the memoir.
So I want to go back to the early 1950s and talk a little bit about what, something you've already mentioned, the theology of the laity, which is he was given the task of developing as he was undergoing his theological training. What is the theology of, what is a theology of the laity, and how do you, in the context of what was going on in the church in the 50s and the 60s, what does that mean?
So what it means is this, that church and Roman Catholicism then, and sadly too much today still, is simply identified with the clergy and the religious. So when people think Roman Catholic Church, a Catholic Church, or when we read in the press, the church this or the church that in that case, they're talking about the bishops, the hierarchy, which would include the priests, the whole ordained hierarchy. So church is identified with that rather small, very small percentage of the total Catholic body. It would include the religious, the sisters and brothers who are not technically in the hierarchy, they're not ordained, but again, they would be seen as highly symbolic representative figures of, now, wow, those are real Catholics, right? No, they're the real. But what was already clear by the early 50s to people that wanted to see it and who cared to see it and who cared about where the church was going in that point in modernity was two things. That the growth of Catholicism demographically could not be served educationally just by priests, nuns, and brothers. That they realized that's not going to work. Now that's a nice problem to have, right? You know, in terms of growth. Not only, in this case it was in the United States, but they could see it also in many parts of the world. So there's that. And then secondly, these are very much the movements already underway for several decades that come to official fruition and realization at the Second Vatican Council in the 60s. What? The recognition that the church most fundamentally is the people of God, or the church is first and foremost the sacrament of the risen crucified Christ, meaning it's all the bodies, all the members of the body are the church. And we see it worked out at Vatican II. Its dogmatic constitution on the church doesn't begin with the hierarchy. It begins with the church as the people of God and the sacrament of Christ. It's now the embodiment of Christ, whose body is not with us, who's gone in the creedal belief to the right hand of God or whatever, ascended to heaven. Well, so there's two things going on. There's the pragmatic point of if we're going to teach the faith, we're going to have a lot of lay people teaching it. That's pragmatic. But secondly, it's not just, oh, well, heck, we've got to deal with the laity and have them do it too. The best of the people looking at this and trying to make the change was the laity are the church. The church isn't just the hierarchy and the religious. So that was the vision. And the last piece of the problem was that the way religion was being taught in colleges to undergrads, and by then you already have some 200 Catholic colleges and universities in the U.S., mostly colleges. The growth of the universities, qua universities, that was limited. There were some, but I'm saying it's largely undergraduate education, was done so poorly. And it was done so poorly because it was being taught by priests, largely, who'd had lousy seminary education. And even if they had some decent seminary education, the way they then were teaching religion to the undergrad was, here's your class in metaphysics, which will prove to you that there's a God, and oh, it's the Christian God, and then we're going to tell you what sacraments are based on Aristotelian metaphysics with Thomas, Aquinas, whatever. And big surprise, everybody hates it. The students hate it. It's something to endure. It's almost like what that makes the Catholic faith is the thing you had. Then you can all tell your stories every 5 years at college reunion about how you survived that horrible course with Father Morrill, where you had to memorize the five proofs for the existence of God.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
So Cook's mandate was to come up with a whole different curriculum. But not only do that for undergrads, but also start training at the master's and doctoral level people who could teach that.
Mm-hmm.
And he writes in the memoir that he had to decide whether to go do the doctorate where. Apparently at the University of Vienna, there was a very good program. There was one also, the Institut Catholique de Paris was just beginning its own, it has its, we would call them departments, they would call them institutes within this. They were starting an institute of religious education or catechetics with this whole new thrust. With a young Dominican friar who was brilliant, Liéger was his name, leading that up, etc. So he made the decision among some choices. I forget what a couple of the others were, but anyway, he chose to go to Paris and do that. And so when he comes back, as I mentioned, within a year and a half, he's chairman of the department at Marquette. And it's not that he single-handedly does it. He has to get some faculty on board, etc., but they just start undertaking this. That's theology of the laity isn't just to write a theology. It's not writing books about what lay people are. It was much more a how do we do theology such that it serves, comes from and meets the actual people,
mm-hmm.
the laos.
Mm-hmm. I was struck when I was reading portions of the book by some of the influences on Cook's thinking.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was obviously influenced by a lot of what we would consider to be pretty heavy hitters, but some of the influences, one influence came from his Tertian director, and you can explain what that is.
Yeah.
Father Karl Vaner, when he was studying in Germany, and another influence was a book that he read by someone named Raoul Plou, called God Within Us. So I was wondering, you know, obviously there are a lot of people who don't know who Karl Vaner was, or
most people,
or what this book was.
Yep.
But these were quite formative for Cook's theology. So what does that tell us about how he went about doing theology, how he developed theological ideas?
I would say most importantly, it tells us that his theology was. And is, in its published form, deeply steeped in the best of the most ancient roots of how Christians theologize and write theology. Namely, it comes from a lot of prayer, it comes from relationships with fellow Christians in community, and relationships in the wider society in which the Christian finds herself or himself. So that's the key thing. You know, the theology we read from the first centuries, these are homilies, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or letters that a bishop like Augustine is writing. Or they're catecheses. They're the instructions that John Chrysostom or Ambrose are giving to neophytes. So theology isn't what it becomes in modernity, by modernity, of this, you know, we're going to prove we're theologians because we're abstract philosophical thinkers, and I can tell you I know my Kant, and I'm going to prove it, you know, and, you know. Now, he did get all that education, as you mentioned. I mean, he's a highly, he's a brilliant man and a very well-educated man. And the Jesuits put you through all that. You had to have a philosophy degree as well as a theology degree as well as then your doctorate beyond that. I mean, lots of that. But yeah, it's beautiful. I'm grateful to you that you read the book so closely. He's got a particular individual person that's so formative, and the man of this German Jesuit priest, Karl Vaner. But when he was a novice, moving way back to his beginning of his Jesuit life, the first 2 years for a Jesuit are in the novitiate, which is that, they're novices, they're neophytes. It's an intensive kind of training period. Apparently, in that era, in the 40s, still, you could only read because you only could read what the novice master handed you or gave you permission to read.
Hmm.
And I guess among a selection were some various books of Christian spirituality, and one of them was by this Raoul Plou. But the key thing that Cook says was God Within Us was the title. What struck him was a small book, which I read during my sabbatical at Fordham. I was glad to find they had a copy of it in their library. What struck him was a book that was insisting from the first page and describing how God is not some distant concept we argue about and give proofs for the existence of. Nor even is God someone that, well, we have priests here in the Mass who can dispense God to us somehow and make a connection for us. But rather, God exists in the spirit of each of us. It's a spirituality. And Plou was a Jesuit, and I can see he was already someone in the movement in the early 20th century that was retranslating what the Jesuit founder 400 years before was up to in his spiritual exercises, St. Ignatius Loyola. And that was methods of prayer and meditation and contemplation where in one's own human narrative, each person's own story becomes inhabited by God and starts to meet God's story. And God wants to be, if that works, God wants to be in the story of your life. In a very affective and personal in the sense of it's really in your life, your daily life, the big movements of your life, and that is where, quote, unquote, God is.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was enough in a young Bernard Cook, he entered the novitiate right out of high school, as they used to do back then, 18 years old. And he describes in his childhood, and I won't take the time to do it, but again, how did I select and pick to mm-hmm. get to that? He describes his own parents and his, and a lot of things, but how he could have been so primed then when he reads this book as a novice that he said he couldn't put it down. He read it three times, four times. Now, obviously, to read a small book that much, he's reading it really slowly and pausing and reflecting and praying with it. He said he read it so much until the novice master right. in a meeting said, hand me that book. Took the book from him and said, enough already. Read something else. So it had that impact, but it was about... Now, this is a man then whose theological method, and this isn't unique to him at all, right? In fact, when I was at a meeting of the Catholic Theological Society of America this summer, their annual convention, I was lucky enough to get a whole session on the book and got four colleagues to give panel of each part. And I purposely picked some younger people, two older people, two younger people. And one of them was a young scholar, a Franciscan priest, Dan Horan. And he appreciated the fundamental theology in the first part of the book. That was his task. He just finished his doctorate at Boston College. That's what I wanted him to do. He did it very well. But of course, toward the end of his 8 minutes, he goes, but you know, none of this is very new. Like what Cook is writing in the 1980s about theology based on experience. And I knew that. And so I gave a very knowing nod in the panel session. No, it's not. I mean, you can turn to Karl Rahner in the way he did it, for us Catholics at least. You can turn to Bernard Lonergan, if you want to think of the big, big guns of the 20th century, if that metaphor doesn't offend. Or you could turn to Protestant theologians, reaching back to Schleiermacher, or forward to Tillich. I mean, so this is not news as a method, generically. But there is quite a unique way which Cook did it, his own experience-based methodology, or making experience fundamental to theology. And that book, when he's 18, in a very holistic way, was the base, I think, or right, so that theology for him is not just about arguing ideas, it comes deeply out of an experience of God with people. Karl Vaynar, so that's the beginning of his Jesuit formation. Jesuits go through, and in his case, having entered right out of high school, he didn't even have a bachelor's degree, his formation would have lasted, and it did, it lasted about 12 or 14 years. A couple years of noviceship, and then 4 years to do a bachelor's degree, which included, the bachelor's degree basically was with a what we call today a major in philosophy. And even when I was trained as a Jesuit many years later and entered already with a bachelor's, we had to all make sure we had 36 credits in philosophy.
Wow.
So it would often take 2 years after the novitiate. I had a lot in college at Holy Cross, so I didn't have to do as much. In my case, I therefore was able to do an anthropology degree, get the philosophy done in a year, then go do the anthro. So he would have done 2 years of novitiate, 4 years of what we would call undergrad. They call it juniorate back then. And then you teach. You're a regent. You teach for 3 years in a high school. So he taught for 3 years up in, I think, Milwaukee, at the Jesuit High School in Milwaukee. Then you go and you do the MDiv, which is a 3 or 4 year degree. Now it's 3. I think back then it was 4. Having done all of that, you add it up, right? Mm. You get to the point you're ordained a priest. Then quickly thereafter, you do yet a last year of formation, tertianship, tertio, third. It's a third year of noviceship.
Mm.
2 years as a novice in the front end.
That's interesting.
The idea is at the end, you are taken out of all that busyness and everything again to a very intensive time in which it's devoted mostly to prayer, making again the 30-day spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius in silence, which you do at the beginning as a novice. You do it again. It's very refreshing. We think of it now, I think, in the language of sabbatical, I suppose. And only after all of that are you called to final full profession as a Jesuit, unlike other religious congregations and orders. That comes much later than on the front end. Okay. Cook asked his superiors, could I please not do tertianship here in the United States? Because the problem in the early 50s was it was run like a class again. It was so divorced from experience. A tertian master simply sat in front of 40 Jesuits and for months on end lectured at them. And that wasn't Ignatius's idea. But in Europe, they were already recovering a much more back-to-the-roots approach. No, tertianship should be a series of experiments or trials in Ignatius's language, just like a novice. You get sent out to do things that really take you out of your depth and challenge you. And you do the long retreat, the 30-day retreat, but it's not lectured at you. There are talks, perhaps, or fervorinos or presentations, but the bulk of it is most of the day in your own silence doing the exercises, doing the meditations, not being lectured at them about them.
Mm-hmm.
So he knew that somehow, probably from some other Jesuits older than him that had come back from their doctorates and were saying, hey, they're doing some stuff over there that's pretty good. And they agreed, fine, you can do your tertianship in Germany. Now, this is 1951, I think.
Mm.
So it's still a Germany recovering from the war, as was Paris when he was there doing his doctorate immediately after that for 3 or 4 years. But he goes there, and this guy, Karl Vena, had been already the provincial superior of a whole region of Jesuits in Germany twice, two different regions. Now he was given this very important task of the last formation step. It's quite a thing to entrust an individual with, to prepare these guys to be fully incorporated as Jesuits and take up the leadership and be the full deal. Vayner has this impact on him because he was one of these people opening up the spirituality of the Jesuits, the spiritual exercises in that way. And if the Raoul Plou book 14 years before had so impacted him as a novice, Cook, in a way that having the spiritual exercises lectured at him in the novitiate, blah, that didn't do it. It's like he had this openness so that when he meets Vayner and Vayner starts leading a tertianship in that form of sitting down with every man from the start and saying, well, who are you? Tell me about you and let's guide you. It just was, he was totally taken with him. But clearly it was mutual, because in very humble ways, Cook will mention, like, well, it's not that he showed favoritism, but when we go on these hikes, it seems he always asked me to be his hiking partner. Well, he told Cook at one point during the long retreat, if you don't want to bother coming to my talks, and you want to just stick with what you're reading and reflecting on, you don't feel like you have to come, which is a very humble thing. I mean, in what used to be a very, I'm running my classes, you know, world. And Cook writes so beautifully in the memoir, he goes, I never would have dreamed of missing one of his talks. Mm. You know, they were just transforming him. And he goes, and when I'd meet with Vayner and then he'd ask me to tell him what I thought, He said, I always felt like I was carrying coal to Newcastle, but Clea was very mutual. So there was a deep father-son bond, or teacher-mentor, whatever, mentor. So I think that's why Vayner had an impact. Vayner, he recounts to us, Cook does, was hauled in before, personally, before Hitler three times. And so he also admires his character. The man must have been quite remarkable. And many Jesuits perished in the Third Reich. And Cook describes when he moved to the building where he went to learn German for the summer before he started tertianship, which I God, how much German it was, must have been mind-boggling. But the place he was sent to in Bavaria had plaques on the front entrance while he was waiting to be met. In the Porter's Lodge, they had the placards of those who died on the Eastern Front, those who died on the Western Front, those who died not on the front, which would be Dachau or other places, and those who were unaccounted for. And they were many. The Jesuits ran afoul of the Third Reich pretty early. Dachau was where they sent the priests. And I once got to visit Dachau and stand at the foundation. It's the 28th barrack. Number 28 was where they incarcerated. It was called the Priesterblock, the priest's barrack. So Vayner apparently scared the crap out of Hitler. That when every time he was brought in, Hitler would kind of crumble, Vayner recounts, if you stood up to him. That's how he says he got by. It's remarkable. Cook comes back from one of the experiments on his tertianship when he was sent to work in a hospital, or for a time in a military base, a NATO-type base. He comes back from these experiments and Vayner's gone. And it's because the Iron Curtain's gone up, or going up, and he's the first one that the Jesuit leadership in Rome decides can handle being the superior behind the Iron Curtain. And gone. So he's a figure that I think for Cook, a lot of Cook's writing, and Cook became very involved in the anti-Vietnam movement. He became very involved in the African-American or black students movement in the late 60s. It's one of the reasons he left the Jesuits in Marquette. He ran afoul of the leadership over his role with the black students, etc. Vayner obviously was an inspiration to him also as a guy who lived the faith on the cutting edge in political trouble.
Right. Yeah. Great, thank you.
Long story, but it's a good one,
I think. So I'm going to turn now to looking a little bit at the book not exactly more detail, because we are looking in detail, but looking at it a little bit differently. So the book is divided, the bulk of the book is divided into four sections, theological method, Jesus, sacraments, and church. And then each of these has a number of subtopics. We're not going to be able to obviously cover everything in this interview, but I did want to highlight some of the central aspects of Cook's life and work. And one is an aspect that you've already mentioned, which is the relationship, which is the relationship between revelation and I've got experience slash history. They're not exactly the same, but they're close. So that relationship is central to Cook's theological method. So I'm wondering, what do these terms mean, and how do they relate?
Yeah. So Cook would be on the most basic level influenced by the German theologian Karl Rahner and others, not exclusively Rahner, but Rahner would be a strong representative of this. That our experience of God and God's presence and activity in our world is pre-thematic, in the sense that before we often even thematize or reflect upon or explain or tell a story about, that's what would be theme. Before we do any of that, is already a more primordial or basic or fundamental experience that's happening. So there's a theology in that saying that this is where God, and he has a very strong pneumatology, this is where God is spirit, the spirit of God as the way God reaches humanity, is dwelling and active in our lives. And then he's saying that history in relation to experience is always already how humans are making sense of, narrating, and analyzing what has happened in experience, right? In one sense, we often think of the historical as what happened in the past, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Cook even developed a phrase where he says, history for each of us or in communities of groups together is vicarious experience.
Mm-hmm.
That for him, therefore, experience fundamentally is what each human subject, each human person is both undergoing and reflecting on. But he also wants to have a term for how this is done communally, that we're not just autonomous individuals, but communally. But furthermore, not just synchronic, like whatever is new and relevant is what matters, or, how do we take account of all the wisdom and all the tragedy and all the good and all the bad, blah, 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 of the past? And he says, in that sense, history is vicarious experience because we're always already interpreting what we're learning about from the past. I mean, again, this isn't unique to him, right? That the idea that we are hermeneutically engaged, when we engage history. But the terminology he preferred to use was experience and vicarious experience.
Mm-hmm.
Knowing, and this is how he wrote his pneumatology, his Christology, and when we try to do that with Jesus of Nazareth, we have huge limits about what we could possibly know about him, what Jesus' personal inner, if you will, metaphorically speaking, experience was. Because the ancient Semitic and late Greco-Roman world, psychology, the way we think of it now, and subjectivity, it's not there, right? So he acknowledges all that, but still he's saying, if we don't, he argues at the front of his Christology, if we were to say that we can't know anything of, or somehow meet, hermeneutically, Jesus's experience, then really, what could we possibly do? What could we do as Christian theologians vis-a-vis a claim about a theology of the Trinity? I mean, the Trinity emerges only because of what Jesus and those around him experience about God that he says is going on with God, right?
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you don't have a Trinity at all. You don't just pull that out of the air. So that's what Cook was up to with that.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote a pair of articles for a journal called Philosophy and Theology, that journal in the 80s, on this notion of experience and vicarious experience methodologically, and relates it, interestingly, not to Jesus, but to the prophet Jeremiah.
Mm.
So he wants to say also that biblical experience, the way the books of the Bible are given us and the way Christians interpret them, thus Old Testament as an interpretation of the Hebrew Bible. All of this comes with a strong, comes in the framework of prophetic experience,
mm-hmm.
because Jesus was a prophet. Historically, that can be said.
Mm-hmm.
Some call him maybe rabbi, but I agree with the interpretation historically that he was a prophet. That's how people would have understood him in his own time, which either positively or negatively.
Mm-hmm.
So Cook uses that kind of a framework. And then he, therefore, develops a pneumatology. The second part of the book deals with not only Jesus, but the Spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll forego details, like you say, after watch our time. His approach to sacramental theology, the third part of the book, was to say that human friendship is the basic sacrament, that all humans live sacramentally, not just Christians. Now, one could say, well, wait a minute, what do you mean by sacramental? And, well, he does. He'll spell that out. But what he wants to say is the kind of, we all live only symbolically. If to be human is to experience, the only way we can experience is via symbol and narrative. But even words are symbols, right? So we live symbolically. But he wants to push the word symbol into the sacramental saying, and in that we are encountering God, whether we know it explicitly or not.
Mm-hmm.
And whether you're Christian or anything, he wants to say that this is how God is active. And so, of course, you have to have an image of God that's much bigger than our categories, right?
Mm-hmm.
Oof! But he pulls it in and says, bigger than any of our categories, and yet imminent in everyone's lives. And he posits that friendship is the fundamental locus for this experience of God, that it informs all the rest of our experience. Is that anthropocentric? Yes, but he's saying we're humans. But maybe I posed the question in a way he wouldn't have there. So he says, and on what basis, finally? He says, well, for Christians, this is the case because of the biblical content of the faith, that it's all relational, both humans among humans and then humans with God. And even with God, it's described as God interacting with humans, and especially in Jesus. So it's strongly Raoul Plou. You know, it's very Christological from his noviceship forward and in the spiritual exercises. So that's what's going on. And then finally, so especially with regard to the Eucharist, so the Roman Catholic and wider Christian experience of encountering Christ in word and sacrament in that ritual. So the biblical content and then the very bodily, affective sharing at the table of the bread and the wine, etc. The final move in the book about ministry, he can only speak, and he writes about the church in relation to how the church is a service to one another and to the world. It's a very service-oriented. So ministry is intrinsic to the way he treats church. And, the last step was one of his, in the book, I include an entire book chapter. I do a little editing because of page limits. But I take big chunks of a chapter he wrote on the authority of everybody's experience in the church, but in the perspective of Latino Catholicism. The last part of his life, even in his 80s, he was teaching as a visiting or an adjunct or a guest professor at the University of San Diego, which is, of course, right on the border with Mexico, and it's a Catholic faculty of theology where they were working really hard at developing Latino theology. And even though he was a white guy, they were happy to have him there, and they asked him to contribute methodologically to this. And so he wrote on the authority of the experience. And by then, he and his wife had been 15 years in retirement after Holy Cross, but living both in Texas and San Diego. And she was working with immigrant Latinas, women.
Mm-hmm.
And so through her and with her, he was able to learn more about the experience. And so I just think it's touching that at the end of his career and at the end of the book, I'm able to show how this guy, through all those 60 years of adulthood, was always trying to pay attention to and be on the ground level of where was the people's, the laity's, the laos, the people's experience, popular experience happening. And in the end of his life, he said he could see it was with this growing population of Latino Catholics.
As I said, I'm sort of picking and choosing from from the book, but another question I wanted to ask you had to do with his use of biblical texts.
Good.
They seem to be a very significant resource for his thinking, and I'm wondering, you know, if you could talk about why that would be and how you would characterize how he, you've already sort of gestured in that direction,
sure.
But how you would characterize his use.
Yes, well, I would say, first of all, myself as a theologian, a Christian theologian, theology, for it to be Christian theology, has to be biblical.
Mm-hmm.
From the origins of Christianity, it's people reflecting and explicitly speaking about the scriptures or looking at what's going on in experience in light of scripture. So the biblical content of the faith is fundamental to theologizing. Now that got lost sight of in a lot of Catholic theology, tragically. I mean, in this way, that after the Reformation, the Catholic version of Reformation became very syllogistic in its teaching, very abstract, I would call it a bastardizing or a dumbing down or a distortion of the brilliant medieval theology like of Aquinas. Whereas if you read Aquinas, he's constantly quoting scripture. Now, you might disagree with the way he does it or what methodologies he had at hand in the 13th century. Sure. But by golly, scripture is all through it. No, what Cook gets stuck with in the 20th century as a Jesuit scholastic, you're not reading the Bible much at all. And they hadn't been for a couple centuries. And instead, it's this manual theology where here's your manual, and you're going to have these proofs for this and these defenses for that and apologetics for this and explanations for that, which rarely, if ever, touched on Scripture. The revolution in Catholicism in the 20th century was to blow that wide open so that in the 1950s, Pope Pius XII issues a document on Revelation and on the role of Scripture in it, which reverses that bad pattern. Notice I said the 1950s again, mm-hmm. right? So this is when Cook himself is coming of age as a theologian. And that he did it in Paris was most fortuitous. He doesn't say in the memoir that he did it. In fact, he makes it clear in the memoir. He goes there because of the questions about cutting-edge methodology for theology in Paris and their developing methods of religious education. That's why he goes to Paris, to the Institut Catholique. But when he gets there in the memoir, he describes how he figures he wants to write his theology working with the early Christian sources, what we would call patristics. And therefore, he goes to a guy by the name of Jean Danielou, who is one of the most prominent French theologians of that period and a patristic scholar. But as they talk more and more about what he wants to do, Cook's interests are strongly biblical. And he's very taken, and it's not surprising, with the notion of covenant as a relational category between God and people. God and the Jewish people, God's people of God, the chosen people, if you will. But then the language of new covenant in the New Testament, in the epistolary literature. It's so consistent, right, that this is a relational thing, and he sees it as relational. And so what Danielou says to him is, well, then I can't direct your dissertation. That doesn't, I'll be on your committee. But you need to do this with a biblical scholar. Cook's question to Danielou is, why don't I see any covenant language in patristic literature? And Danielou says, I don't know. But you're right, it's not there. If you want covenant, then you need to do New Testament. So he ends up writing his dissertation on the concept of covenant in the Last Supper pericopes, because that's where Jesus in Matthew, Mark, and Luke says either, this is the cup of the covenant in my blood, or this is the cup of the blood of the covenant. But both of those things going on, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and 1 Corinthians, have to do with how they're linking, the Christian origins is linking it to the Sinai covenant. And the blood ritual done at the foot of the Mount Sinai when Moses throws blood on the people and this bonds them. Because blood in Semitic world is life. We even use the phrase to say your lifeblood. The idea was if blood isn't coursing through your veins and your veins have gone flat, you're dead, right? To put it very simply that way. But blood is it. So Cook ends up writing his dissertation on that, about the what we call the Last Supper in the New Testament. And therefore, it set the pace for all of, and therefore, of course, you could bet, he did went to a lot of lectures and had to really get good at biblical exegesis, such as was the state of the methodology at the 1950s. And so his theology becomes very biblical. From there on in, that's how he does it. And he does it because he's always looking to Scripture as covenantal, as God relating to humanity, humanity to God. That's what's going on.
You've mentioned this, but I wanted to ask you, perhaps in a slightly different way, that Cook privileged the sacramentality of friendship, including marriage, and he has a sort of a community-oriented ecclesiology.
Yep.
It was hard for me not to see these as related. For the first one, the sacramentality of marriage to his own marriage.
Exactly.
With Pauline Turner, and then also the ecclesiology, the community-oriented ecclesiology, seemed to be related to some of his negative experiences with the church hierarchy, both at Marquette and then other stages of his life. So granted that theologians, and not just theologians, may focus on topics in their research and writing that arise from their own lived experiences. Do you see this happening sort of in an intensified way in Bernard Cook?
Yeah.
And how does, this is one, I think one term we haven't mentioned possibly yet is his notion of a down-to-earth theology.
Oh.
So I wanted to, do you see this related in some way to, to this down-to-earth theology idea?
Yeah, he would use down-to-earth as the phrase for how he wanted to do theology because he was, in the best sense, a popularizer. So if you remember, I said he was part of the mandate he got at the front end was to find ways to develop curricula and ways of doing theology that would meet people where they're at.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we'd use the word popular in that sense,
okay.
where the populace is. I think because popular in American rhetoric can mean somehow thin or, you know, not, popular can mean faddish, or, you know, the connotations, that he preferred to use the phrase down to earth. But what he meant was theology, because God, theology only matters about what God is doing with people on this earth and people with God. So he wants it to be down to earth. And it was very much the friendship, colleagueship that he developed with Pauline Turner in the 60s at Marquette. And of course, I have to include a lot of that that I extract from the memoir to make this clear, that she had been an English grad student who switched to theology. As his theology program developed, that's where she found her passion. She actually taught there for many years as an adjunct, and they worked together in developing programming, such that, as he describes it, over the years, they just became such collaborators that he goes, you could call it falling in love, but it wasn't just like they swooned for each other. It was a like a working relationship that developed into a very good, deep friendship that developed into a bond of love that would be marriage. But of course, to fall in love that way is, not he, but another Jesuit said to me years ago, you have to be falling out of love with being in the Society of Jesus, the Jesuits. And there was that concurrent event, eventuality, where he, like I already mentioned, found himself at odds with the administration over his and a few other Jesuits, really, how they tried to help the black students in 19, especially in 68 when everything reached a crisis level in universities with African-American students, Vietnam, and the whole thing. But also he'd become more dissonant with the Jesuit leadership. There could be that vision, and there was, on the part of some of the wider provincial level leadership of the Jesuits about where the church was going, what theology should be. That doesn't mean that the Jesuits individually who were running, who had the power to run at Marquette University, were on the same page. And Cook was also on the front end of ecumenism and interreligious stuff. He says in his memoir, the best friend he made and remembers from his Marquette years was a Jewish rabbi in that city, whose name evades me right now, but apparently was very prominent. But they found each other very quickly, and it was the rabbi who read about what Cook was doing and came to meet him. I mean, these are wonderful stories. But there was a lot he was trying to do that way, and with Methodists, and he would get all this hate mail from the right-wing Catholics, because there's a lot of that back then and still in Catholicism, over what he was doing. Was he, you know, selling out to Protestants and all this stuff? He didn't find a lot of the Jesuit leadership backing him up very well, or the hiring. So there's all that negative story. So that stuff's going on, while I'm sure he's commiserating on that with Pauline, who's become his best friend. And so there's the story. But also, I think, because the Jesuits were still in the 1940s and 50s through his formation, that formation still was one that was totally depersonalized. From the time you entered the novitiate, you were not to ever have a particular friend, was the phrase in English. Everybody should be your friend, but you should never develop close friendships. And part of that had to do with, I think, a fear of, you've got all these 18, 19-year-old boys with the hormones charging, just like, I guess, at British prep schools, and it might be homosexual activity, blah, blah, blah. That's part of it. But it was also a very dehumanizing, like, what makes us be religious is that we are indifferent to personal friendship. Well, that was a sick system. And a lot of people left it. Now, some might get angry, older Jesuits than me now, and say, don't say that it was that, but it's played out in the numbers that in the 1960s, and Cook was one of them, men and women left religious life, and nuns and priests and brothers left in droves. I mean, we're talking by the thousands. I was only a kid in grammar school when that was going on, so I'm not saying I was fully aware of it, but I wasn't away. Our Catholic grammar school in Brewer, Maine closed in 1968. The nuns just quit in droves, and people stopped sending their... Anyway, so there was a very... There was also, I think, for him an exhilaration in discovering what he was reading about and experiencing about God relating everything, and discovering that that's what friendship is, and that really catalyzed how he understood Christian experience and sacrament. And finally, his first major book was entitled Christian Sacrament and Christian Personality. It was a rather American, very modern 1960s American psychological appropriation of Karl Rahner and Edward Skillebase's cutting-edge sacramental theology that came out in the late 50s, early 60s. He published it in 65. He had a way of appropriating it and, again, communicating it, but it came through this register. In his Sacraments and Sacramentality, a book he published in 1983, almost 20 years later from that first one on the sacrament, he's still got a lot of the same principles going on, but what he says on the front of the book, which was quite bold, was he said that marriage is the basic Christian sacrament, not even baptism. And that raised hackles in all sorts of directions. And he revised the book in 1994, mostly to open it out to gay, lesbian, and other experience, which in 1983 still, it wasn't even on his radar screen that much. But as the issue was raised to him, and through his wife, who at that time did a ministry degree, another degree, at EDS, the Episcopal Divinity School, worked with Carter Hayward and a lot of lesbian women, he would go to the meetings with her, and he was invited into them. And so it just opened up again. A guy who's always open to these new venues of experience, he opened it up then to say much more that it's basic, any kind of deep, committed friendships. And he always meant by it friendship in the broadest sense of the term. A relationship between a parent and a child is a friendship. A relationship between a husband and a wife or a partner is a friendship. Any kind of deep interpersonal relationship, he means friendship. And maybe that still draws on some of the classic and the Renaissance philosophy that used that term, you know, in Latin. So I may have gone way too long there, off the track from your question, but does that answer?
Yeah,
that's where he got to it.
It seems like, you know, he did have sort of, I mean, he had this, you've described, I think, it as openness. He had this intense openness to experience, and it perhaps more than some folks do in terms of how they relate their experience to what they might be doing otherwise in terms of scholarship.
Right. Yeah. It was all integral. It was all of a piece.
Yeah.
And then with regard to church also, I've talked about how he ran in tension in the 60s with the Marquette administration. I want to add just here, Marquette University in around early 2000s gave him an honorary doctorate. So it's really a beautiful end to that story. I think it was in 2003 they gave him an honorary doctorate of religious education. So some things came full circle. Needless to say, the old powers that be were all in their grave by 2003. But a lot of people he'd worked with, and then their theological faculty there now, you know, who were very proud that he was their founding person. So years before. He also ran into trouble when I mentioned his work with the Jewish people, with the Methodists and other Christians ecumenically. He actually, and then his anti-Vietnam War stuff. A lot of the arch-conservative Catholics were, of course, also John Birchers or other kind of right-winger type people. There was a very difficult moment in the late 60s when, out of just one letter that he thought, which he wasn't shown, was written about him and sent to the Vatican ambassador and nuncio in Washington, D.C., basically defaming him. And it shocked him that that letter, or I guess it originally went maybe to the Archdiocese of Marquette, Milwaukee. No, it didn't. It went directly to the guy in Washington. He said he couldn't believe that the Vatican Embassy in Washington would take any one letter from some individual so seriously, and denouncing that he's a communist, and you know, all that baiting that was going on at that time, and that he was publicly heterodox. He was denouncing the faith and all that, which he was, but only because he was relating to other Christians. The letter gets sent to the chancellor, the second in command of the Archdiocese of Milwaukee, who calls him in and is all upset. First of all, embarrassed that this is happening, but also Cook could figure out very worried, because such a powerful figure in the hierarchical system wants this dealt with. It's almost like the chancellor of the Archdiocese of Milwaukee feels like he's already on the carpet.
Mm.
And Cook found that very unnerving,
mm.
that it's such a powerful patronage system that anybody at any level, if anybody above them, can already be quaking in their boots that way. It's like, just this really is unsettling. So he found that those were some of the stories that unnerved him, but also one that I do include from the memoir in the book was at the very end of the 60s, one of international speaking tours he made was to sub-Saharan Africa, mm-hmm. and he lectured in, I think, 3 sub-Saharan African countries, and the Anglophone ones. And in one of them, there was already a document. They were preparing for the 1970 Synod. After Vatican II, a new governance system was starting where every 5 years, a certain selection of bishops from around the world would come and meet with the Pope in Vatican to address current issues. And the first one was on the priesthood, because it was already collapsing. People talk today, okay, I got to get my little soapbox here. But right now in Catholicism, it drives me crazy at age 57, that in 2016, people are talking like the shortage of priests is a new evolving problem. It began when I was a kid in the 70s. Mm. And already the number of priests and parishes were thinning, and already they were consolidating parishes by the 1980s. This is it, but again, it serves ideological purposes to keep acting like this is a new problem. It's a deeply systemic problem that began in my youth and when Cook was in the zenith of his career there at Marquette. So he goes on the speaking tour in sub-Saharan Africa and is, of course, in seminaries and things. And there's some of those sub-Saharan African bishops were already trying to produce a postulate for that synod about a married priesthood.
Hmm.
And they got a letter back from some Vatican office saying, you are not to bring this up. And he says the closing line of the letter, which he said he was given to read, though he shouldn't have been given to read, was, don't forget that the dicastery for the propagation of the faith finances you. So it was a very thinly veiled threat. You bring this up, and we're going to stop giving you all the funding that you need as a missionary territory. And he said that, in a sense, was the last nail in the coffin, that any misgivings he had about leaving the priesthood were done.
Mm-hmm.
And he went back to the States, and they kind of moved through on it. So those were some of those things. Whereas what he's experiencing visiting sub-Saharan Africa, as he describes it in the story, was the vitality of the growing church mm-hmm. there. He was very inspired by the Jesuits there, all sorts of stuff. So he had, more than ever, the church is the community on the ground level, down to earth.
Right.
And he really, the rest of his career, and I'm completely influenced by that, but I own it myself, deeply anti-clerical. And what's basically will keep the Roman Catholic Church ineffective in so many ways that it shouldn't be is the clericalism. There, I said it.
And you've also segued nicely into the last question that I have for you, which is how have Bernard Cook's life and work influenced you? And particularly as you reflect on this collection of writings that you've put together.
Yeah. Oh, it's a lovely and very touching question, Chris. And in one sense, I guess I want to say right away, and why then do the book at all?
You know,
because some people challenge me all along the way of like, well, he had his day and he was a very important figure, but why should we read about him now kind of thing? Well, because I think that when one gets into his story, with the way he wrote the theology, it's an example of how we should keep doing theology, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the inspiration. Not that we have to go back and revisit Vatican II time or Vietnam War time. That's not the point, right? It's much more of, here is a model of someone who didn't just theorize about it, but shows you how you do it.
Mm-hmm.
So he was that for me. When I knew him, first met him, he was already 10 years having left the Jesuits. He had already, so he'd come to the faculty at Holy Cross. I had a seminar with him, and I was like, oh, it was like, yeah, wow. Like, not that I had many other very fine professors there, but you could see. But he was so personal and pastoral. And I remember talking with him about, toward the end of my senior year, I was going to join the Jesuit Volunteer Corps, and I did. I went off to be a lay volunteer. We predate Peace Corps, in fact, modeled it. But go off and work with the poor for a year, and they'd set up these placements. But I said, you know, I'm really thinking about becoming a Jesuit. I'd started to think about it my senior year, but I was going to go off and volunteer. I wasn't ready to say I want to enter, you know. He was nothing but totally supportive of that, right? Mm-hmm. So some people I've heard over the years, and obviously I have a passion about it, said he was trying to destroy the Jesuits. Once he left, he had nothing good to say. It wasn't true at all. I mean, he ended up spending the last part of his career teaching at what arguably is one of our most prominent institutions, and did it. I found him totally supportive of me or of my vocation. In fact, he pressed to have Jesuit novices. By then, there were, in the New England province, Jesuits who entered the novitiate with a PhD, that people are entering much older, mm-hmm. and often came through their studies and had degrees in church history or philosophy. He pressed the president of Holy Cross to let some of those novices do their experiments there as teachers. And the president was like, no, no, it cuts away from our prestige, or, you know, we don't want adjuncts that way. And he was pressing for, I'll have my department. He'd bring these guys in. So these gross accusations, I guess I'm making this defense, it wasn't even asked for. But I'm saying he was a person who still loved the Society of Jesus. And I presented myself as someone in the subsequent years becoming a Jesuit. He was very supportive. But I also really liked, and he was a role model for me, for this being open to what really is going on,
mm-hmm.
and what's going on with you in relation to what you're experiencing. And I could get back to visit him at times, you know, and he's the guy who gave me advice, so you want to be a sacramental theologian? He said, you need a social science degree. Like, do an anthropology degree. Get good ritual theory, because we're not going to talk anymore about matter and form and metaphysics and this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's how is it done on down to earth. And so with his backing, I was able to convince my superiors to let me do the degree at Columbia in anthropology, a master's degree, and so forth. So that's why, for me, why it was so touching that of all the people he taught over the years, I'm the person that he and his wife figured out they wanted to entrust the papers and the stuff to.
Mm-hmm.
To me, is very touching. And it's not like I saw him that often. It was usually just every couple of years, but we always kept in touch. And it's touching to me, I guess I'll say it, he said it to me and apparently to others who fed it back to me, but that he saw in me doing theology the way he dreamed it would be done. It wasn't that other theologians weren't, but maybe because of the trajectory of his life, I'm not one of his doctoral students at Marquette. I'm a kid he taught as an undergrad. So I bring a whole nother generation later.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people that he taught are now retiring, of course, or have retired from the Marquette era. I think he found that, he valued that in me. And so finally, to close, that's why the book project for me was a good one for that sabbatical year. It was a wonderful timing. I hope the book will see some circulation, that people will find it interesting to use, to read. As I say again, finally, as a model.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, also, with Paulist, I understood it thoroughly. My page limit was 250 pages, so I had to do a lot of selecting. But that it will be a book that isn't then just about a dogged march through somebody's court. It wasn't my doctoral dissertation, but it kind of felt like it might have been. It was the exercise, right? But rather, it's suggestive enough that people then can find, to use our own wording today, it'll empower their own voice or their own voices,
right,
to go ahead and do that. It's not that they need his permission. I just think it's one inspiring story example of how you can do that.
Right. Thank you very much. Thank you again for this conversation.
Well, thank you for great questions, Chris.
Again, I've been talking with Bruce Morrill, Edward A. Malloy Chair of Catholic Studies and Professor of Theological Studies, about his recent book, The Essential Writings of Bernard Cook, A Narrative Theology of Church, Sacrament, and Ministry, published by Paulist Press. If you have any comments about this conversation, just browse to the homepage of the Vanderbilt Divinity Library and click on the Ask a Librarian link on that page. We look forward to hearing from you, and thanks for listening.